last presenter is Kari Doyemre, who is going to present on the outbreak of acute childhood lead poisoning in Zamfara State, Nigeria in 2010. Ms. Doyemre, MSN, MPH, and RN, is a second-year epidemic intelligence service officer in the Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Prevention Branch at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, where she works with CDC-funded Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. As an EIS officer, Kari has participated in outbreak investigation in Florida, Michigan, and Nigeria. Prior to joining EIS, she worked in a variety of settings, including two large metropolitan pediatric hospitals in the US and in pediatric clinics in Mexico and Peru. Kari received a master's degree in public health and nursing from Emory University. Welcome, Ms. Kari, to the podium.
Thank you. Good morning. All right. Well, good morning. Today, I'll be discussing the findings from a lead poisoning outbreak in Zamfara State, Nigeria, May and June 2010. I have no relationships to disclose. I've also included the CDC disclaimer on this slide. As far as the presentation, we'll follow the background, methods, results, discussion format. To orient you to Nigeria a little bit, Nigeria is located in Western Africa, you can see by the red arrow. Zamfara State, where the outbreak took place, is depicted in green on the upper right side of your screen. It's in the northwestern part of the country. The red star denotes Nigeria's capital of Abuja, which is in the center. As far as demographics, Nigeria has a population of roughly 150 million people. It's the most populous country in Africa, and it has a life expectancy of 47 years. It has a low per capita income and a high infant mortality rate. As far as Zamfara State, where the outbreak occurred, you can imagine it's a little less than twice the size of New Jersey. It has a population of about 2.3 million people, so it's fairly rural. The two primary ethnic groups of people in this area are Hausa and Fulani tribes, and the primary religion is Muslim. The occupation of people in this area, as I said, it's very rural. It's mainly agrarian, and the state is also known to be rich in minerals. To orient you to lead, give you a little background, lead is a naturally occurring metal. It's ubiquitous in the environment. Lead can be found in many different sources, such as mining areas, gasoline prior to phase out, batteries, toys, and also traditional medicines, to name a few. The primary routes of exposure to lead are through ingestion and inhalation. In children, lead primarily has neurological effects. It causes brain damage, behavior and learning problems, but it also can have other effects such as decreased growth. At high levels, lead can cause convulsions, encephalopathy, and death. Adults can also experience health effects from lead poisoning, and they're related to memory and concentration problems, kidney damage, and also reproductive problems, just to name a few. This slide kind of shows you how lead affects the body. The bottom part of the slide, 10 micrograms per deciliter on the right, is the CDC action level. You can see as you go further up in your exposure, different things happen. So at 40 micrograms per deciliter, it can cause decreased hemoglobin synthesis. It can also decrease vitamin D metabolism. As you go further up, it can cause irreversible brain damage and possible death as you get up to encephalopathy and death at the top of the arrow. Chelation therapy, which is the treatment method for lead poisoning in the U.S., is typically recommended at 45 micrograms per deciliter. So the way we learned about this outbreak, on May 8th, 2010, the CDC's Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Prevention Branch, where I work, learned of reports of up to 200 children with suspected lead poisoning. Most of the children, the majority, were under 5. They also had symptoms such as nausea, irritability, convulsions. So a rapid response team consisting of Nigerian national, so the Nigerian federal government, the Nigerian state government, and also the Nigerian Field Epidemiology and Laboratory Training Program, which is like EIS type of program based in foreign countries, was part of the response. International organizations included Doctors Without Borders, CDC, WHO. We were all assembled together. And the objectives of our investigation were really to characterize the outbreak in terms of person, place, and time. We also wanted to help institute control measures and begin helping Doctors Without Borders with medical management, chelation therapy. And also we wanted to provide recommendations to stakeholders to try to deal with this outbreak. There were three aspects to our investigation. The first was an epidemiologic component. So what we did is we did a house-to-house survey in two of the affected villages. We were able to sample all family compounds, so all households in the area of Village A, and we were able to sample the family compounds in the central area of Village B. Our survey consisted of a census, which included the number of children under 5. It also included questions about child mortality and morbidity in the past 12-month period. Also, we asked about ore processing activities taking place in the home and environmental exposures. And then another component during our house-to-house survey, we collected venous blood from children 2 to 48 months. And then inside each family compound, we also collected a soil sample, so a dust or soil sample from each family compound was collected and analyzed. And this was really all to do one or a few things, really kind of investigate the outbreak and see what was going on. But also at the end, we wanted to be able to give Doctors Without Borders, the instituting organization, a list of where children under 5 lived in each of the villages, what if they were having symptoms, and also their blood lead level. So really to move to that next stage to help kids in the immediate, who had immediate needs. We used descriptive and chi-squared statistics for survey responses using SAS. Our laboratory analysis, in the field we had a device called a lead care 2 machine, which is a portable blood lead analyzer that can be used in the field. So we were able to do on-site blood lead testing. Also, we 84 children had a split blood sample, meaning they had one sample tested on-site and one sample sent to CDC laboratories. And that way, we could test for a suite of heavy metals using inductively coupled mass plasma mass spectroscopy, or ICP-MS, at the CDC laboratory. Also, we could get a better idea of blood lead levels. Environmentally, we used a device on-site called an X-ray fluorescent spectrometer, or XRF machine. What an XRF machine does is you can point it down to the soil, and it'll actually help you determine the heavy metal contents of the soil in real time, so instant results of heavy metal contents in the soil. Additionally, we sent samples to U.S. laboratories. Before we move on to the results, I just wanted to really explain the steps involved in ore processing. There's 6 steps that villagers are performing when they're doing this ore processing. So first the ore is extracted from the ground, and then villagers in the first step is the breaking step. So villagers buy 40 to 60 pound large bags of rock, and what they do is they break the rock down into pebble-sized pieces. So they take larger rocks, breaking them down into pebble-sized pieces. This picture shows a man doing it, but we actually saw a lot of women and children, young boys, participating in the work, helping their families. The second step is the grinding step. So you can see in the bottom right picture, flour grinding machines are used to take the pebble-sized rock and grind it down into a fine powder. Sometimes the powder, or sometimes the rocks, are ground multiple times. We found out that this is a new step in the process. About a year ago, November 2009, the villagers had grinding machines added to their processing. So this is a new step. And it really, if you think about how, if a small child or toddler chews on a rock, you know, the lead wouldn't be necessarily bioavailable to the kids. So it's hard for the lead to get into the children's bodies. But if you think about taking rocks and grinding them into a fine powder, it really is a very good way to get lead into the body. The next step is the washing step, where they take the dust. They either use a sluice mechanism. We saw those where people were using a sluice mechanism. Or sometimes they use a large pan or pot like that. They put the ore into the pot, and then they use water and wash it. This also helps so they can extract some gold that way. The gold is heavy, so it stays either at the bottom of the pan or the top of the sluice. And then the next step is the drying step, where they take the ore, they lay it out to dry. You can see on the sheet. So sometimes they'd lay it out on flour sacks, sometimes they'd lay it out on sheets, and they would dry the ore. And that's in preparation for the next step, which is the separating step. So basically they take a large pot and they would put the ore into the pot, and then they would add mercury, a few drops of mercury, and the mercury would help amalgamate the gold flakes together to form a nugget. I also want you to take a look at the size of this hand. So it's small. We saw kids maybe 12 years old helping with all of these ore processing activities. The next step is the melting, burning step, which we actually never witnessed. It almost always happens in private, so people don't know how much others have gotten from the gold processing. So basically, they take the small nugget, they put it on a piece of tin foil, they light the tin foil on fire, which then vaporizes the mercury, and it leaves the gold nugget behind, so then they're able to sell that. The final product is just one example we saw. It's on that, you can barely see it. Actually, yesterday, too, gold reached an all-time high. It's $1,400 an ounce right now. So, this table describes our results of the household survey. So the village name is on the left. The total number of children that we found in the village to be alive in the last one-year period is in the middle column. So 463 children under 5 were found to be alive in the last one-year period. The last column identifies the number and percentage of deceased children. So in the one village, 78 children died. Village B, 40 children died, bringing us a total of 118 children, or 25% of the under fives in these two villages died in the last one-year period, which is very tragic. This table, we did a six-month crude mortality rate. So we did the rate per 10,000 children under 5 per day in the two villages that we surveyed. You can see the most impacted group are the birth to, the 3 basically, 0 to 3. And the 1 and 2-year-olds had the highest rates overall. Overall, the crude mortality rate was 12 per 10,000 children per day. And just to give you a reference, the United Nations Commission on Refugees considers child mortality in excess of 4 per 10,000 per day is an indicator that an emergency relief situation is completely out of control. So these are kind of just to give you a little perspective. As far as family participation in ore processing activities, so you can see that rock drying was the most popular activity in Village A, and rock breaking was the most popular activity by family in Village B. As far as activities that occur within the compound, so within the family compounds, this was really important for us. Activities that occur, you can see that 79% of children in Village A and 65% of children in Village B perform one or more ore processing activities within the family compound where children are present. And this really was a direct route of exposure for kids. As far as our results indicate, that we found that children who died were 3 times more likely to live in a family compound that participated in ore processing activities than children who did not live in a family compound who processed ore. The activities of breaking, washing, drying, and separating were all significantly associated with child death, and you can see that by the odds ratio and confidence interval. As far as blood lead level results, we collected 204 venous samples during our investigation. All of the samples that we collected indicated lead poisoning of greater than 10 per micrograms per deciliter. 97% of the children that we sampled met the criteria for chelation therapy, which is 45 or greater. Our portable blood lead analyzer, called the LeadCare 2 machine, has the capacity to read blood lead levels from 3.3 micrograms to 65 micrograms per deciliter. And unfortunately, about 85% of our samples we were not able to read on our machine. It exceeded the capacity of our machine. because of this, 84 samples were sent to the CDC laboratories, so we were able to test those and give us a precise blood lead level. And we found the mean blood lead level in children of Village A to be 153. We found the mean blood lead level of children in Village B to be 107. Extremely high blood lead levels. Our range of blood lead levels was from 36 to 445 micrograms per deciliter. Other heavy metals we found in children's blood were manganese and mercury. As far as environmental samples, we were able to collect them in 116 of 118 family compounds. You can see the range was from 45 to 100,000 parts per million. Basically, we use the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency standard, for a lead hazard in soil, which is areas that have more than 400 parts per million of lead in the soil is a soil lead hazard according to the EPA. And 82% of our samples exceeded the threshold set by the EPA. Also, we had samples sent to laboratory. They also exceeded the standard. And if you can see, the range 45 to 100,000. So 100,000 was, A, the capacity of our machine, so we couldn't read samples above 100,000. But also, if you think, put it in lay terms, 100,000 parts per million is about 10% lead. So children were living in environments that had 10 or greater percent of lead in them. We also did take water and dust samples, a few, and they also exceeded EPA standards. Other heavy metals we found in the soil were arsenic, copper, manganese, mercury, to name a few. And just kind of to discuss and wrap up, this acute pediatric lead poisoning resulting in encephalopathy and death are really rarely reported in the literature these days. This was an unprecedented outbreak in which 25% of children under 5 died. And 83% of that actually occurred in the last 6 months. 100% of the children that we tested had lead poisoning, and 97% of them should receive chelation therapy. We found extensive environmental contamination both inside the households and also in the village itself. The limitations to our study, so we were only able to investigate 2 villages, so we had a small sample size. This is also preliminary data that I'm sharing with you. We're working on more complex and in-depth analysis right now. We made 6 recommendations to stakeholders, including really characterizing the full extent of the outbreak and controlling mining activities, remediating contaminated areas, identifying and remediating contaminated areas, implementing health education. So we were able to disseminate 6 key public health messages shortly after we arrived and kind of figured out what was going on. And those were disseminated to people in the village, but they were also disseminated to other villages in hopes that we can, you know, help if stuff is going on elsewhere. Also to build local capacity. So problems of environmental contamination they take a long time to clean up. There's no instant quick fixes. So we really suggested that they build local capacity to deal with both lead poisoning and the environmental contamination. As far as updates, I didn't want to leave you with all the doom and gloom. I really wanted to give you an update of all the partners and what's been going on. 2 inpatient chelation therapy wards have been set up with Doctors Without Borders. So up 400 children as of September 30th have been chelated by our partner organization, Doctors Without Borders, who've done a magnificent job on the ground. They've actually set up the two hospitals, one by each village. They've also started to do outreach to other villages, and they set up a field laboratory to be able to analyze samples that are coming in. Another organization, Blacksmith Institute and Terra Graphics, they have assessed and completely remediated the 2 villages that we sampled in. So all of the contaminated soil was removed and fresh, clean, uncontaminated soil was placed so that way kids are not having a continued exposure. Another group of colleagues from the United Nations Environmental Program came in September. They came and did some sampling in additional villages using a mobile unit. As far as determining the extent of the contamination and the poisoning, that's in progress right now. CDC has a team working with many partners over there. I just returned 10 days ago from Team 1, and Team 2 is continuing our work, basically going around to other villages, doing a questionnaire, environmental and blood lead sampling to make sure that there aren't other villages that are having similar problems. And then capacity building. So we're mid and long-term actions are really kind of taking shape with multiple international organizations and the national government. And that's it. Thank you.
question time now. We have four presentations, and the presenters are on the podium. If you have any questions, the first is the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and drinking water contaminants in Nebraska. The second presentation relates to association between metabolic syndrome and depression in women, findings from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey 2005 to 2008. And the third is the spatial analysis of indoor and outdoor pollution and world asthma mortality rates using geographic information system. And the last is the outbreak of acute childhood lead poisoning in Zambia. Questions? Yes, sir.
Sure. As far as understanding of the local people of lead poisoning, what's going on, is very complex. I think the people in the village knew they had a problem when we came in. They had seen a lot of child death. We did hear people saying that they thought it was at first for a spiritual or religious reason that, you know, Allah or someone had, you know, that's why the excessive child death was going on. And I think that was the attitude in the beginning. We also had a lot of support from traditional leaders, so the emir, the local traditional leadership system, they had already actually told people to move mining operations outside of the village before we had gotten there, because they had started to kind of put the pieces together, the mining and the excessive child death. So people were really trying to do, you know, what the emir said, moving their mining operations out. As far as the real understanding, that we were able to give them six simple public health messages. So yes, separate the people from the exposure, change clothes, wash hands, don't let children near formal mining sites. We were able to disseminate those messages, and those were our key messages that went first to the people in the villages we were in. But also partners at UNICEF have gotten some central emergency relief funding from the UN, actually. So they've started to get some funding to do social mobilization campaigns. So they're bringing in, they do different kinds of radio bits. They do, because radio is very popular there, that's about the only thing that people have, battery-operated radios. They've been doing plays and stuff like that. So using UNICEF, an existing organization that's already there to really take these key public health messages that we developed and take them to other places has been that. But yeah, I think even just this last time that I was there just a few days ago, they really were trying to do what they needed to do. They knew they needed to move mining out, stop activity, et cetera. And so they would tell me, well, we've moved all the mining out, we're fine, our village is okay. But I don't think they put together that understanding of environmental contamination, once an area is contaminated, is going to stay like that until someone actually comes and cleans it up. So I think it's all moving pieces. Also, UNICEF did activities with just men and just women and stuff. So they're really trying to incorporate it. But yeah, they really didn't have an understanding in the beginning. They knew they had a problem. Some of them anyway knew they had a problem. But and the village chiefs have been really instrumental in helping develop those messages and tell people what's going on. They don't even have a school in one of the villages. They have an Islamic school, but other than that, they don't even have a functioning school. So. Right. So our first phase, and even now continuing, is still kind of a rescue phase, as my branch chief describes it, as we're going in to get children who are at highest risk and will have the most, you know, long-term consequences. But really, children over 5 and also the adults do need attention. So right now we're developing local capacity to do these surveys in villages, stuff like that. So I think through local capacity development and getting people trained on how to take blood samples, you know, what to do, environmental inspection, stuff like that, it'll be going and going and going. But we're still finding villages. So we're in the immediate stage right now. But, you know, as capacity develops and people come and money comes, it'll keep moving forward. So yeah, it's not like we're gonna just focus on that population because we know it has to be expanded. So that's a really good question, and we have some information from different sources on that. So first, we know that there was a source change, that people in the communities may have started going to other sources to get their rock. So the change in the origin of the rock. Also, yes, the amount of people who are mining. So we knew from our survey that people have been mining for as long as 18 years, but that was just a segment of the population. Other parts of the population, two-thirds of the people who we interviewed who said they were mining actually took up mining in the last year or so. So between an increase in a change in source, an increase in people mining, and then the third part is the mechanization. So the changing of the processing to grind the ore down into fine particles, and then having that spread throughout the village is really probably the three areas. But yes, an increase in uptake and a change in the processing and the source as well.
I had contact with the federal ministry. I'm from Nigeria. I did have contact with the Ministry of Health. The mining has been going on for ages, just like she said. It's the grinding machine that new introduction is being used not just to grind the ore, but to grind the maize, the corn, the food, in the food process. So that's where the idea came in. And that has increased the level of exposure because that grinding machine is also used in the home. And that's part of the problem. And along the northwestern part, not just Zamfara, all the other states, the same process is going on. There are all minerals in the air in the region, but it is this mechanism of bringing the soil back home, which has increased the compound, the exposure of children at home. When it's been done out in the fields, it wasn't much of a problem. But now they're including members of the household in the process. So that's part of the problem. I was told that the state of Zamfara, the Minister of Health in Zamfara, they are now in the process of developing a legislation to make it illegal for them to bring the soil back home. Yes, there was no understanding that the soil contained heavy metals and that the exposure what resulted from the oil processing, because it's been going on for long. It's not just this year. It's the fact that rather than being done out in the fields, it's now being done within the compound and where children. I have even worse pictures sent to me of where children just play as if they're on the playground, where the all mining is taking place within the compound.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cuthbert?
What has been done so far to characterize that work? Important to note that artisanal gold mining is a worldwide problem that has been approached and is being approached by the United Nations or other groups because of problems in almost all countries. Is it there?
Right.
In South America,
India,
Indonesia, Africa, other parts of Africa. And most of the time, lead is not an issue in artisanal gold mining.
Right.
So what do we know about the geological characterization of the soil and the ore? Because to my knowledge, usually gold-containing ores are not very high in lead, per se. They tend to be higher in other metals, like arsenic, things like that.
Yeah, we're actually, Dr. Plumley, with the U.S. Geological Survey behind you, we're working very close with them. They're analyzing some of our samples and informing us and helping us learn about the geologic composition of the soil there. They've done some testing where the majority of samples, you can step in at any time, because this is not my area. Exactly. Quite variable, so if there's ways that we And we're working with the Nigerian Ministry of Mines and Steel, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Environment and Solid Minerals. There's many ministries all kind of involved. And we had an exit meeting with them, and they're moving towards, and they're acknowledging or figuring out what they need to do. So involving the UN, the UNIDO project, so safe mining, other things. So the pieces are coming together. It's just going to be a process.
Okay, let's one last question so we can go. So, yes.
About your presentation about adequate and worldwide, I think your conclusions are right on the mark that we don't understand as much about the epidemiology of asthma as we thought we did. In fact, in the next session, I'm going to have a presentation about looking locally in New Jersey, and we find tremendous local variation in asthma rates when you examine that systematically statewide, with more than about a twofold difference locally among the 21 counties, but with rates varied by 5 or 10 times when you look at more local regions, either by municipality or school district. And part of the reason we did that was we had areas such as in one country where they seem to have an asthma problem than we would have expected anything. And one of those areas we investigated is linked to a electric power plant called Fire. Of course, the state lines in Pennsylvania is only directed down the river into this beautiful farm in wine country. So there's a lot of work that we need to do in both indoor and outdoor and other influences. Not just in some of the urban regions where we find it. And I think as we get more and more data on some of the places globally dissect out, where we find tremendous variation within some of those countries too.
Yeah, it's definitely not, my urban population came out insignificant, and I definitely think it's because there's so many other factors relating to it. And so many other, like you said, in wine country of all places. So there's definitely different factors in different regions that I think could cause indoor and outdoor pollution, which is why it shows that indoor or outdoor pollution is correlated with asthma, when really it could be any other factor. So that's very interesting.
Any other questions for the other presenters? Yes. Any more questions? Okay, thank you for your attention and for your presence.